You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Linda Ronstadt is one of the most beloved singers of the baby boom generation. In fact, when President Obama gave her the National Medal of Arts last month, he leaned in and told her that he had a little crush on her as a boy. I feel you, Mr. President.
And I've been kicked by the wind, robbed by the sleet, had my head stolen, but I'm still on my feet and I'm still willing.
Ronstadt has sold more than 100 million records, and really, her popularity has endured because she's so good, but also because she's so good at switching up styles. Rock and roll, country, then operetta and mariachi. This spring, Linda Ronstadt was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and her memoir, Simple Dreams, is coming out in paperback this fall. I spoke with her last year, just a few weeks after she'd announced that her singing days are done. Linda Ronstadt, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much for having me.
The case you make in the book is that the range of music you were exposed to as a kid in the 1950s, I guess, and early 60s was sort of a well you kept drawing from for your whole career. I want to play this Mexican ballad that you apparently learned as a girl.
El cañal está en su punto, hoy comienza la molienda.
So you actually seem moved once again these years later hearing yourself sing that.
Well, it's not me. It's the music. It's the song. You know, that's a beautiful, beautiful song about a huapanguero. The huapango is a certain kind of Mexican song that's you hear in the mountains. It's where you break into a thrilling kind of soaring yodel. And there's certain people that can really do it well, and they're revered, you know, in the culture. That song talks about a mill turning around to grind the sugarcane, and the Rogaciano, this thrilling singer, has died, and everyone's in mourning, and the whole entire countryside, even the mill, when it moves around, it sighs, you know, every time it makes a revolution. You know, it's a beautiful, beautiful, rich song. I love it.
And growing up in Arizona and having Spanish songs as part of your...
Mexican songs,
Spanish language songs. Was there something as you heard songs like that as a kid that made you say, I can do that, or I really, really want to do that?
I always wanted to do that. And when we were kids, everybody in my family sang in Spanish and English. You know, everybody was bilingual completely except for me. And I thought that Spanish was a language you sang in and English was what you spoke. But if there was a party or some kind of a celebration, you know, the guitars would come out and people would start singing in two languages and we'd crawl up into somebody's lap and fall asleep with this wonderful male voices in my family, all rich, beautiful, deep baritone voices.
And speaking of going to bed and going to sleep to music, I in the book, I love the songs that you say your mother and father would sing to you at bedtime. They are really, really dark, like some Roald Dahl murder ballad. Yeah, I wish.
My parents were so nice.
I mean, Leave It to Beaver never had songs like this. If you could maybe just read
some. Yeah,
that
wasn't the truth. Nobody believed that stuff, really.
Some of the lyrics of the one your mom sang?
She'd sing, "Last night my darling baby died. She died committing suicide. Some say she died despite us of spinal meningitis. She was a nasty baby anyway."
So not only grotesque and mean, but funny.
We sang back to her, "Oh, don't go in the cage tonight, mother darling, for the lions are ferocious and may bite. And when they get their angry fits, they may tear you all to bits. So don't go in the lion's cage tonight."
And was
in
it
harmony, we would sing this
in
story.
Spanish?
In English.
In English.
Yeah.
Instead of being a purely idyllic childhood, that gives it a nice edge.
Well, my father would sing to us a beautiful song that he learned from his mother from northern Mexico. It was called Arriba en el cielo se vive un coyote con ojos de plata y los pies de azogue. Up in the sky there lives a coyote with silver eyes and feet of mercury. Kill it for a thief. From underneath the floor there goes a rat. Kill it with a stake.
And was this just...
Very soothing.
I mean, what was it about them that chose to present you, darling little Linda, with these...
Well,
songs.
Maybe parents just get so desperate they'll threaten you with anything. If you don't shut up, the rat's going to come and get you, you know. I don't know. The coyote with the quicksilver eyes, that's a lovely image. I thought
totally.
That was nice.
In the book, you kind of skip the point where you get your big break, or maybe you didn't get one big break and it was instead a gradual process.
It was kind of like that,
in your early 20s. But when it was happening in the late 60s, was that scary? Were you self-conscious about performing, about being famous?
I was pretty self-conscious about not being very good yet. You know,
really?
I think that it takes a long time to learn to do anything well. And I took about 10 years to learn how to sing. I mean, I was just really kind of wandering around in the dark trying to copy.
Really? So until 1976, you couldn't really sing?
I didn't really think so. And really, maybe not until after 1980 was when I really,
really?
Got going. Yeah.
So there you were, Linda Ronstadt, and you really felt, did at the time in 1977, you feel like, I'm not really all I should be?
I thought that very strongly, and I wanted to do more, and I wanted to do stuff that was a very custom fit, not only to my voice, but to my sensibility, you know. And I grew up with this wacky background in the desert, you know, it's not like everybody else. And I grew up bicultural. A lot of the songs that I'd heard when I was a child, I thought were better songs than some of the mainstream pop things, a lot of the mainstream pop things that I was getting. I thought they were better. I wanted to do them.
You talk in the book about this turning point when you see Emmylou Harris for the first time and you are hugely impressed with her talent and make this conscious decision to like her. I'm going to like her even though I'm jealous of her great ability. I'm going to play you singing with Emmylou and Dolly Parton, Do I Ever Cross Your Mind?
And when I think of you and the love we once knew,
I never have been very competitive in terms of art. I think competition is a good thing for a horse race. But I think that she was doing what I was doing, exactly what I was trying to do. And she, in my opinion, she was doing it much better. And I think she still does. But you know what?
Although she only, to be fair, was only doing one part of all of the things.
Yeah, but I hadn't done all those other things yet. And I was chasing country rock at the time. And Chris Hillman had told me that he was sure we were going to like each other. He had such respect for Emmy. And I knew I was going to like her. It was something very extraordinary that happened up on that stage that night. I already loved her. So I thought, I can love her and I can be jealous and it'll spoil every note I ever hear that she sings. Or I can just love her and just admire and step back and admire. And maybe I'll get to sing with her.
And it worked out.
So she was busy singing with Graham at the time. But, you know, eventually I got to sing with her. Best decision I ever made, by
really?
The way, emotionally.
Did it last beyond Emmylou Harris? And did it, like...
With everything else I've ever encountered like that. I mean, it was just a huge... I never was particularly afflicted of the green-eyed monster, but... That was a time I just told it to f*** off, you know.
I was interested that as you moved to these bigger and bigger venues and were playing arenas and kind of hated them and hated the sound and hated the aesthetic of that performative experience, that's when you said, okay, I'm going to sing opera. I'm going to do Gilbert and Sullivan.
Well, that was operetta.
I know.
I wanted to
but
be—
But La Boheme, opera.
The Greeks had it right, you know, when they designed the proscenium stage. A theater is there to give you an experience of magical reality. And there are a lot of processes that change your mind. You know, you walk in and you're in the entryway there in the lobby, and already you've made a deliberate attempt to separate yourself from the people on the street that are going to do whatever, and you're going to go see this show. So if you're in a real theater, it's like a machine to get people to pay attention to you. Now, if you're in one of those sporting arenas, people are out buying a beer, they're buying a hot dog, they're passing a joint, they're checking out what their girlfriend's wearing.
Watching the moon, yeah.
Yeah, anything. You have to struggle hard. And now, I just wanted to sing in a real theater with a curtain. Isn't that stupid?
No.
I wanted a curtain and a proscenium.
Really? It wasn't...
I wanted a sound system.
But it was sure...
Lights.
All that, but I'm sure... But wasn't it kind of a stubborn... I can't be pigeonholed. I can do this, too. And I can do this, too.
And I just wanted to do something that was really good, you know, that was people really listened and you were really doing it, like you were really on stage doing it right.
Was there anything – I mean, you tried so many different things and these – really? Linda Ronstadt's doing that? Really? Linda Ronstadt's doing that? Was there ever anything you wanted to do that you just didn't get to in that sense?
I was just thinking about that in the car on the way over. I wish I could have sung Kurt Vile until it came out my ears. I love – oh, God. I love songs from the Three Penny Opera. I love Mahogany. I love I love September Song. Oh, God, I want to sing September Song, and I can't sing.
When you started talking last month about how you have been diagnosed with Parkinson's and apparently have had it for some years, you said, well, and you can't sing, and you haven't been able to sing for years. What does that mean, that you can't sing to your satisfaction? You can sing better than I can, no doubt.
No, I can't sing at all. The muscles – see, Parkinson's particularly affects your muscles.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with the muscles, but there's a guy, you know, sitting in your brain, you know, making a phone call to the muscles saying, move in this certain exquisite way. I can't get to the note. It's like taking the elevator. You push 9, you go to 13, you know. You know, eventually you freeze with Parkinson's disease.
Yeah. Do you want to be involved in music if you can't sing, or?
Well, I am involved in music because a big part of it is hearing. I mean, music is 99% hearing. And the other 1%, it's like visual art. It's 99% seeing, and the rest is what you can draw. I'm involved with a group in Northern California in the East Bay called Los Ensondles. And I've been involved with them for 20-plus years, and they do an amazing job in a little strip mall of teaching children, mostly immigrants' children, traditional Mexican music, and these children come out really knowing how to use music for their life.
So before I let you go, I want you to choose which of your songs that we should play you out on. Which is the best one that people should leave this conversation hearing?
Well, I think maybe I'd like to play the last thing I ever recorded as a solo artist. I had learned to recraft my singing voice at that point. I was kind of doing the best I could with what I had. I had found a different way to tell a story. And it's a record that I made with John Boylan, who was there in the beginning. We sort of came around full circle. It's called Just Tell Him I Said Hello.
That it shall be. Linda Ronstadt, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me.
Linda Ronstadt's memoir, Simple Dreams, will be out in paperback in September.
If he should ask you, but he won't, I know, 'cause it's all over. Just tell.